and welcome to Untold, a podcast where we go behind the scenes and uncover the untold stories of food and drink businesses. I'm Harry, founder of The Savourist.
I'm Mariana, founder of Hullabaloo. We want to uncover some of the stories from founders and business leaders that wouldn't normally be told. Everyone talks about the positives, the sexy stuff, the new product launches, the NPD, the Tesco listings, the million-pound raises.
We want to hear about the not-so-great things, the nitty-gritty and the emotional toll this can have on founder and business leader mental health. Over the next few months, we're going to be talking to founders and business leaders about their untold stories.
Everyone goes through these challenging moments. It's a fact of life. It's time to talk about them and encourage others to do the same.
So today we have a very exciting guest. Mr. Ed Hock is co-founder of The Curators, previously co-founder of a drinks brand called Suzo. Ed, hello, mate. How are you doing?
Very good, mate. Lovely to join you. I'm very impressed, mate, with what you're building. This is pretty cool. You've had some stellar guests, far more exciting than me, I might add.
No, not at all. But no, it's a really fun project, actually, and just really kind of enjoying the process. Like, it just came out of nowhere, really. Like,
following Mark Turner and John Stapleton is not an easy gig, mate.
I'm sure you'll do it justice. What you're building is absolutely fantastic. Well, as you know, at Untold, we want to uncover the stories that go behind the scenes, the ones that aren't spoken about as much. Lots of people talk about on LinkedIn and social media. It's kind of playing the game, isn't it, about and sort of pushing the brand. And what we want to do is uncover some of the stories where things didn't go quite as well, and the kind of the detriment to the founder that it had, and the sleepless nights and all that sort of stuff. And the vision for us is that other founders out there going through those problems, potentially at different timelines, but can listen to this and know that everyone else has gone through it. And it is just a part of the game. It's a part of founding a business and going through that. So to kick off, I mean, if you can give us a couple of minutes, a sort of whistle-stop tour of the career so far, and we can go from there.
It's been a long career, Harry. It might be more than a whistle-stop tour if I try and get it all in. Not a young whippersnapper like you, mate. I was fortunate to, I guess, bounced out of uni like a lot of wide-eyed young 20-somethings with probably too much education and not enough experience. And always knew that I wanted to go into brand world, that kind of environment. My folks actually had a marketing agency. My whole life as a kid, I was just surrounded by boxes of samples from, you know, the world of Unilever and Bird's Eye and P&G and so on. And it was quite an exciting and interesting insight into how brands actually get created. Many summers spent, you know, working in my mum's office, doing all sorts of grunty jobs, but just learning a lot about brands. So I kind of had an affinity pretty quickly that I would get into that world. Started at L'Oreal as a wide-eyed graduate, an incredible environment to kind of craft your commercial skills and your sort of brand mindset. Quite an arrogant business, actually, in some ways, confident/arrogant, just really an assertive, strong brand-led business. And I loved it, absolutely loved it, bouncing around with my peers and working on, you know, accounts like Sainsbury's and Boots and Superdrug and so on. And it was just that cut and thrust, that excitement of being in FMCG. Everything was moving quickly and I absolutely loved it. I ended up spending a couple of my next jobs in the fashion industry. So I worked for Levi's in the UK. You might not remember this, but there was a lot of drama about 501s turning up in Tesco, piled high on pallets at the front of the store. This is going back to the kind of early noughties when people still wore 501s and twisted denim and all that stuff. So we worked on a grocery strategy for the business, which had never really been done before. So I couldn't have enjoyed that more, really. Got the itch to go traveling, disappeared for 12 months, found my inner confidence and maturity to kind of realize, well, actually what I really wanted to do was build a business of my own. Quite a big thing to take on in your 20s. I didn't really have the kind of kahunas to go for it on my own. So it was always about sharing the journey. One of my really good mates from L'Oreal, a guy called Shawnee Pritchard, had just set up the Relentless Energy proposition in the UK, which is owned by Coke. But The kind of story goes that I think he challenged a Coke exec a little bit too pissed up one night over a dinner party and said, your energy proposition is a joke and I've got some ideas. And, you know, I'm not sure if that's folklore or truth, but certainly the stories he tells at dinner parties. It was just exciting seeing him build the Relentless business. I helped out actually on a bit of the UK stuff, and they really set that up as a challenger brand. They were in a little sort of... almost like a hut really on the side of a wakeboarding park in Thorpe. And that was owned, it was a Coke brand, but it was really driven with a challenger brand mindset. And all about kind of lifestyle marketing. So across like BMX and wakeboard and motocross and music and all that stuff. So Sean took all the learnings really from that. He was probably getting a bit disillusioned handing out cans of, you know, 500 ml energy drink to kids, and he was building his own family. And what we wanted to launch was a better for you soft drink, but with all the kind of lifestyle credentials of a Red Bull or a Relentless or a Monster. And we had actually the MD of Red Bull involved in the business, myself, Sean, and another friend from L'Oreal, Jamie. And off we went. And it was my first experience of, you know, blank canvas.
Amazing.
Created an amazing agency in London who created the brand identity. And we had some funding to get us up and running. We had a crappy little arch under the railway line in Clapham that an artist had been kicked out of, and had cans of Tennant Super in the corner and his wild graffiti ramblings all over the wall. And we had to kind of like strip it back, whitewash the wall. But it was so exciting. You know, I'd never experienced anything like that. And the strategy was to be written. You know, there was no kind of here's the kind of the cookie cutter guide to how you launch a challenger brand soft drink. Mm. And around then, I guess you probably had Innocent were really getting into their full pomp and really pushing into multiple channels. This predates your Uglies and your Seltzer movement and your Dalston's and so on. And the whole proposition was based on lots of fruit juice, great ingredients, natural, but marketed as in a sort of cool and exciting way, if you like. And we had some great success. I think, you know, we built a nice business over the 3-4 years. You know, the fast growth going into the grocers, pushing into the food service channel, which at the time was really not a sexy channel like it is now. I think you might know Paul Lederer, who's a good friend of mine, who founded the Tapped business, who
yes,
was at Innocent. He was the food service manager at the time. And we used to laugh, like we were going to local catering association, you know, conferences where it was, I don't mean this disparagingly, but it was dinner ladies basically on a freebie for the day. and you're like there with your gazebo and your Land Rover and you're doing the Larry marketing bit. And it's, you know, it was really interesting, but it was a brand new channel. Yeah. Brands like Alibi were launching, Innocent were really pushing into there for the first time and ourselves.
Amazing.
So I had a ball. It was bloody hard work. Like the first time I really realized, like, holy moly, like a startup is hard. You know, there are no free passes at all. And you all had to wear multiple hats. You've been through this, mate. You know what it's like. If you have to build POS kits at, you know, 11 o'clock at night until 1 a.m. just to get them out the next day, or if you've got an order that needs to be made, it's got to be done. Like there's no structure behind you that just wheels into action and makes it happen.
Yeah.
And we built the business up nicely. You know, I think probably at our pomp we were pushing towards 5-6 million revenue at our peak. The food service channel went from zero to, you know, a multi-million pound operation very quickly. Landed
wow.
Business like Compass nationally, for example. But 2009 was a shit show. You probably might remember the financial crash, and what that really meant for retail was just a recession. It was, you know, my first experience of being in a recession as an employee in a business. My mum used to talk about the recession of the 80s and how hard it was, but I didn't really know what that meant.
Yeah.
And it was just tough. You know, I remember going into Morrison's for the first time and seeing buy one, get two free, and thinking... Oh, we might have a chat. And that was on Pepsi Max 1 liter. And I was like, this could be spicy.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was just the trade were basically just building a war chest to discount their way through it. You know, obviously Tesco famously got hauled over the coals in the aftermath for beating suppliers up in various ways, which I did have personal experience of. I love Tesco, by the way. I think they're a fantastic partner. But there were some tough conversations, and you know, they were doing it for the right reasons. They wanted to to be competitive. So it put the business under a lot of pressure, a lot of strain on the P&L, on our cash flow. It was impossible to raise money in that environment. There was none, really. And ultimately, in the end, it became a business in distress, and you know, it was tough to keep financing. So we actually sold it to our supplier,
wow.
which turned out to be good for the brand, probably good for all of us. And you know, I think a lot of what you want to hear about on this podcast, right, is about the possibility of failure, the reality of failure. Does it really matter to your life? You know, what happens afterwards? There's a whole, you know, lessons to be learned, I think, about your first enterprise isn't necessarily the one that makes you successful. And it was a great success in many ways. It was just difficult to keep it going in the guise it was.
Yeah. I think there's a really interesting point there as well. And I think it's something we haven't really spoken about on the podcast yet, but hoping to kind of uncover in the future is that age old question around like what classifies success, and it's all very personal, isn't it? So it's kind of like success to one person could be selling a multi-million pound business, and success to another person is actually we gave it a bloody good crack and I had a fantastic time and a load of experience. And it's actually kind of like it's just always an individual thing, isn't it?
I think so. And even the four of us the principal three that kind of got the business up and running, and Marcus, actually Sean's brother, we'd all take something different out of it. You know, ultimately, we had investors, so I feel very responsible for not giving them the returns that were promised for the business, and that is really hard. So sometimes you do have to look someone in the eye and accept that we did fail. We didn't deliver on the potential or the promise. But you have to take something out of it. If it's just about the end destination, you'll miss the whole point. Like, you know, sound a bit cheesy, but this is just life. You know, we are just here to exist and do good things and hopefully have some fun on the way. That there isn't an easy way to kind of package up where you end up if it's not quite what you intended. It's difficult. You have to come to some difficult, honest realizations. But if you're not enjoying the journey or you're not taking something out of it, why the fuck are you doing it? Excuse my French.
No. It makes total sense.
You're not saving lives, right? You are trying to build something, but you're not saving lives. And that is, and I think it's important to remember that. I have forgotten that on many occasions.
Yeah.
As we all do, you know, I think, oh God, this is the end of the world. And it never is.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. And I have I think it was this morning or yesterday afternoon, sent a buyer who hasn't replied to us for a while, saying the subject email was
Do you just hate me?
The subject email was like, we're not building a rocket ship, it is only a snack bar, but why can't you just try it? And like it's just pulling it back into like actually what is going on here. Like
did he respond to that?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And look, this year, if anything, must have taught some of us a bit of context, right? I mean, this has been a life and death year in many real and difficult ways for a lot of people. And I love what I do. I take it very seriously. And I also, I feel we add value. We're building a business. We pay our taxes. We're employing people that go on, you know, to build careers and, you know, may make a great mark on the industry. So I take a lot from all of that. But there are times where you just got to remember, like, if it's hurting your health or it's affecting your life in ways that are just not are beyond the pale, don't do it.
Yeah.
Do something else, you know. So anyway, look, it was a great experience, and I took a huge amount of learnings from it, not least the whole food service channel, which I'd never really had any exposure to, and I learned a crap ton about. And I think that's, you know, experience I've carried forward into the curators and many other sort of smaller businesses I've given a bit of advice to over the years. But having bounced out of Suso and wondering what the hell to do, I had a couple of temporary roles. I worked for Puma in the UK, which was great fun. And I actually fell into consulting for startup food and drink brands. You know, Barney and the Fuel and Jason and the Fuel 10K guys well. Yeah. That was my first client, so I have to give him a shout out as a thank you. But you know, worked for Causton for Steve. Worked for Sipsmith, the Collective Dairy, Propercorn, Metcalfe's, Pip and Nut, Bear Nibbles, like these wonderful brands that were just building scale, challenging the market, disrupting, building really cool cultures. And I was just lucky enough to go in and be a sounding board, offer a bit of advice, mainly around sort of people and building capability around teams and performance mindset and all that stuff, which I love with a bit of a sporting background. I love that whole kind of performance mindset, competitive mindset stuff.
Did
that for 3 or 4 years, and that's how I met Max. I got introduced by Amelia, who set up the Collective Dairy in the UK, was a colleague of mine at L'Oreal, in fact. And I don't know if this is 100% true, but I think she worked for me briefly, and I remember thinking, oh no, she's gonna have my job in about 5 minutes. She was so good, and she still is an absolute commercial powerhouse, and I realized that very quickly. But anyway, we remained very, very good friends. She introduced me to Max. We worked together for a bit, just got on immediately. You know what it's like when you meet someone that you just kind of get it, and it was easy. And we both had he was exiting the Metcalfe's business to Kettle. He was in the process of selling that business for Julian Metcalfe, and always wanted to kind of have his own name on something. He'd helped build the Goo business with James Arbadeek. He'd been instrumental in building the Metcalfe's business to a sizable revenue, and wanted to have a go himself, and I was ready. Amazing. So it all kind of came together.
Class. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, what well-rounded career there, mate. It's it really is a
squiggly career.
Well, it's a deep dive into FMCG, that's for sure. Amazing. And I know we had a catch up earlier this week with what we were going to talk about on this. And I think what became very apparent for both of us, what we felt would be an interesting topic is the kind of early days of curators, I guess, and sort of how that process started and the headaches that came with it, and also I guess the learnings from a previous business. If you can kind of give us the headline story.
Spotted history.
There we go.
Well, look, stop me if I'm waffling, but
not at all.
The early genesis of the business was really off the back of, I guess you go through a few phases of the business, don't you? You go through this kind of conception phase, which is like the idea. And I am guilty of having a million ideas, not all of them very good ones, but they all get written down somewhere. And I was building up this kind of head of steam around food where I was like, oh, you know, there's a great opportunity over here and there's a great opportunity over there. And it was all becoming a bit much. And actually sitting down with Max really helped just to talk it through. You know, we were like, well, what do we stand for? What do we really think is cool and fun? And we're like, well, look, we love food. We were bonding over things like Meatopia and Smokestack and going to Temper and the innovation in the restaurant scene. We're like, okay, that clearly inspires us both. We've got a snacks and drinks, an impulse, you know, retail background. That's what we know. So how do we marry up kind of what we're passionate about with what we know, with where we think there's an opportunity? And it was like, if you can cascade those things together, it's like, well, that's worth having a look at, right? So we went to the US together on a trade trip. We went to a couple of shows. And one of the categories that just really leapt out to us over there was the meat snack space. And my dad had worked in the US a lot. I'd traveled a bit around South Africa and Australia with my sporting background and stuff, and playing a bit of hockey and just on my year out. And I just loved great beef jerky done well or great built on was just something I loved to have. It sort of filled a gap in my exercise life. So it was like protein and energy, but it also great with a pint. I was like, yeah, there's something in this we could get excited about. And going to the US, just seeing the brands breaking through there, they were doing the kind of, for want of a better expression, they were bringing the proper corn magic to popcorn, they were bringing to meat snacks, you know, bringing that lifestyle credentials, working with Culinary Institute on the one hand and then Michael Phelps on the other, you know, bringing that together. But like, there is definitely a gap for that somewhere in the UK market. And so really the key is, can you find a product that meets your expectations and your ambition? And I don't really have a great answer for how we got there. I think you just have to go meet a load of people. You've, I think, been through this with the Savourist yourself, right? You just have to go press the flesh and meet the market, and just eventually you'll come to two or three partners that you think, oh, these are great, they've got the capability or they have the right attitude and so on. Yeah. And we met a fantastic bunch of lads down in Sussex, in Chichester, who were making what we thought was just fantastic built on, but had some similar ambitions that as we did to just disrupt the jerky category in the UK, which albeit wasn't huge, we felt there was a lack of competition. There were basically a couple of big incumbents doing product that felt a bit like the old school stuff in the US that sometimes wasn't great, you know, either a bit chewy or plasticky or sugary or whatever. There were compromises that we felt could be addressed. And ultimately, you do have to figure out what problem are you solving as a brand, right? You've got to be solving some, either premiumizing something or make it better, make it cheaper, or make it sexier. One way or another, you've got to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And these guys just saw the opportunity alongside us and wanted to lean into the innovation. And really, our product is quite simple to make. Our first beef jerky product, is quite simple to make, but it's quite labor intensive. You literally lay, you know, strips of beef out on trays and you dry it in chambers, and it's, you know, quite a hands-on product to make. And to make it on scale, you ultimately have to cut a few corners, or, you know, build in some quite big processes. You have to potentially use things like sugar as a controlling product to manage the moisture content. Lots of things where you get into the nitty-gritty, the operational side of it. It was quite a challenge to conceive of a way of doing it better or doing it cheaper and being able to scale it.
Yeah.
And our good friends down in Chichester, who love, you know, a bit of kit and they love a process, had basically designed on paper a manufacturing process that was game changing. On paper was game changing. The caveat, on paper. but, you know, there was a lot of good rationale behind it, and I don't regret any of the decisions we made at the time. But essentially, the guys had designed an engineering solution to the manufacturing process that meant you could put more product through a process that yielded a really high-quality product. So many a time was spent down in the factory in hairnets and beardnets, as you know well, and white coats, experimenting on smaller bits of kit to see if the process worked. We had heating systems that were, you know, brand new, that required sophisticated engineering. I'm not actually bald. I blew the top of my hair off with a gas cylinder. There's a true story. The owner of the factory nearly killed me in a development session, which involved a flame throwing incident across my forehead.
Oh my word.
But you know, I've got scars on my hands from the bits of kit, which I still love because they're part of my story now. So I don't regret them for a minute.
Yeah.
But look, we spent quite a long time refining this process till we were pretty much ready to go. And that was in 2017. And I think we'd hoped to launch at lunch that year, which is always in the September, October, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in the end, we just couldn't get ready for lunch. It was pushing it too far. So we launched at Pub 18, which is a pub show at Olympia in early 2018, in January. And it was all systems go. We had product ready, you know, bagged and ready to sample with the world. And beef jerky was going to be our first foray into the market. And there were a few really credible competitors, Billy Franks and a few others were sort of had broken through, but hadn't really built the kind of business that I think we aspired to. As with our background, was like, no, we want to build a multi-million-pound brand. That's what we're here to do. And it was at that show I got the fateful phone call from the factory saying, we've got a massive problem. The line's down, and we're just trying to fix it, and it probably will take a while. And at that point, I think we had a distribution agreement with a wholesaler. I won't name and shame, but a big one. We had, in fact, two wholesalers ready to go. We had a potential retail opportunity ready to go. And it literally was like, we're going to be shipping product next month. And it took a couple of months to get us up and running. And it was difficult. It was technical. It required lots of re-engineering of the process, and there were some proper moments of like, what are we doing? You have to decide with innovation. There comes a watershed moment. It's like, is this innovation really worth it? Like, are we adding enough value to the category or to the format or whatever to make it worth pushing through with this? And if you decide at the end of that the answer is yes, then you got to push. You just got to keep pushing through. Yeah. You will come to a solution eventually. But there is, I think that's important for brands to stop and reflect on. There's perhaps a bit of a bell curve with innovation. It's like the more you innovate, the better the opportunity becomes, until you innovate too much and then you come down the other side and it doesn't return. It's not worth it. You know, a bike doesn't need six wheels. It's like, let's be really clear. Like, why is the innovation serving a purpose? What problem are you solving?
Yeah, that makes total sense.
So we decided it was worth pushing on. There was enough value in what we were doing. We actually ended up bringing in a friend very serendipitously, who basically, it turned out, my brother knew somebody who was like, worked at Sainsbury's in technical for 20 years and thought it was worth a chat. And then after a chat, it was like, yeah, I can solve that in 7 days. I was like, what? Like, no, yeah, don't worry. We've got an idea. We can solve that in 7 days. And lo and behold, they kind of did. And we were back up and running. And we're like, what the hell?
Oh, my word.
So that's led me to another great insight, which I hope a lot of the founders or startup, you know, operators who listen to this will take out, is ask for help.
Yeah.
Sit there suffering, thinking you got to solve it on your own. You know, just ask.
Yeah. It's so true, isn't it?
And I think someone will help. Like, you, look, mate, we're on, how many WhatsApp groups are we on?
Almost it's too many now, but
probably, you know, but they're just lovely people in our industry. You know, there's always going to be a bit of competitive tension, and there'll always be a bit of looking over your shoulder and all that stuff that goes on. But 99 times out of 100, it doesn't matter who it is, they'll want to help.
Yeah.
No one wants a startup to fail. Yeah. I don't want my competitors to fail. Like, that's not what I'm here. I want us to challenge the big guys. You know, let's all go collectively, take a chunk out of PepsiCo and Unilever and, you know, Intersnack and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's so true.
But really, it's just making sure you have the kind of humility to ask, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree. And there's nothing better than kind of like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 founders having a few beers or out on the golf course, whatever, just chewing the fat. And it, like, I actually on a social level love it. Like, talking shop with other people 100%. Who are as passionate, as motivated and as excited about what they're doing is just the most thrilling thing in the world.
And hopefully honest. Like, it's important to be honest, right? It's never all roses, no matter what LinkedIn might suggest.
Well,
it's such an amazingly friendly industry.
Yeah.
Like, I literally just spent 2 hours having lunch with my main competitor today.
Right.
I think that's very kind of normal in our industry. And I don't know if other industries are like that or if it's just startup life.
Totally. Like, you know, we compete a lot with brands like the Snaffling Pig Boys and Ember and so on in our space. We're all close competitors, but, you know, all of us have been through our own challenges personally and professionally. And without any specifics, it doesn't take much more than a text message to say, shit, mate, that sounds pretty bad. You know, hope you're all right. If there's anything we can do, just give me a shout.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it goes both ways. And then you dust yourself off and you go and fight over space in a retailer.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and,
it.
And that,
that's it.
But that is, I think, the spirit of our industry. At least I'd like to think so. And
yeah, sure. I completely agree. It's in and out of the game, isn't it? It's like,
I think
it's,
so.
Yeah, no, it's so. And Ed, I just want to kind of go back because I think there's a really, really sort of key bit here. Around the kind of manufacturing process. Like, I know I've been through it, Mariana's going through it, has been through it. And that phone call when they call you being like, this isn't gonna happen. You're not gonna go. Like, what do you do? How do you dust yourself off? What emotionally, what's going through your mind?
The first thing is the heart rate goes through the roof, doesn't it? And that leads to the capillaries opening and the sweat pouring. And there's definitely, for me, there's always like a physical response. I have to go away and just literally take a deep breath because, you know, you just need to calm down because the adrenaline will kick in and it will make you catastrophize things in quick speed. And actually Max is such a great foil for me as an individual because he knows I'm a bit of a flapper and a bit of a drama queen. And actually he's good and calm under pressure, but he can be too calm and sometimes he needs me to agitate as well. And we're really good foil for each other. So again, just one of my learnings from this process is don't do it on your own. You know, I think co-founder experience is really helpful. I know it's difficult to find one and you've had your own challenges with that, mate. Like, finding a partner to go on the journey with is not easy, but is really important. So there was a take a deep breath moment and then let's just talk this through. What are our options? What can we do? And just pick apart the problem in pieces. It will seem massive, but you just have to break it down. And we managed to sort of break this down into some operational issues at the site, but also this relationship issue with the local authority and so on. And just went and asked for as much help as we could. We just scratch your head, like, who's an expert on this? Because we're not. And eventually it just led to this perhaps a bit of luck. Like, I do think the best startups, as brilliantly as they're executed, whether it's your BrewDogs or, you know, your grenades or whatever, you sometimes do have to ride out a bit of luck.
Yeah.
You know, it's perspiration, inspiration, and a shit ton of luck, right?
So we
got a bit lucky and found someone who just happened to be working on this process with the government around how you support factories through innovation. She helped get us in front of the right people to navigate the EHO, and we found a solution. In fact, what I love about this, and we'll probably one day there's a book in this, but it led from, you know, disaster head in hands, we don't have a business, to being invited to number 10 Downing Street to go and present to a government a government aide of Theresa May.
That's unbelievable.
On how we'd lent on this government scheme.
That's amazing. That's absolutely fantastic.
You can't beat that, can you?
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. And I think that sort of process, like anybody who has started a food and drink brand ever in the world who sits there and go, oh yeah, manufacturing was pretty easy, like is lying. That kind of, especially I know we do have quite a few listeners who are very early on in their journey slash kind of still in that kind of idea phase. It's like, do keep plugging away and do keep asking questions. Like Brassen, it's not something we'll go into now, but we launched with launched in inverted commas with a previous manufacturer, and exactly the same. We're supposed to be at lunch, and a week before they were like, we're not gonna move forward with production. I mean, we'll produce you some product for lunch, but then you got to go elsewhere. And I was like, what the fuck is the point in that? Like,
yeah, cheers for that.
Yeah, exactly. And you just kind of have to, like, I think as well, something that I've got out that there is, like, and it takes me back to school. I mean, I was crap at school, but the learning process and that key stage, the kind of, what was it called? A bite-sized process of learning. Mm. Like, it goes the same way. It's like, if you're going, I want to start a business and build it to £multi-million, it is fucking Everest. If you're going, right, I'm here, how do I get to them? Right, I need to find a manufacturer. So who do I know that might know a manufacturer? Let's have a chat to them and then go and have a meeting. And like breaking it down into those individual steps kind of helps. And obviously it's...
Yeah. And I think you have to be really clear on what you're trying to do and marry the partners you work with to that plan. So for us, we were always intending to get into a mainstream grocer. So we had to work with someone who could scale. You know, we had to know that if this thing blew up and we were doing 1 million packs a year, can they do 1 million packs or 2 million packs or 10 million packs, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really important. If you're not building that business, you're building something that is perhaps more of a lifestyle business, or you have more modest ambitions. You just want to, you know, you want the business to be something, you know, artisanal, that you're really proud of, that is number one in Selfridges, but doesn't need to be number one in Tesco, then you need a different supplier for that too. And really understand your supplier well, like, what are they good at? What are they not good at? Be really honest and clear about those things, and just take your time to pick the right partners. It's really important. We've talked about this a lot. Like, ultimately, it's probably going to take you twice as long as you think to get the product right.
Yeah.
And you need to have the time and the cash to do that. And as long as you can, don't hope it's going to take twice as long, but just be ready for it to take twice as long. If you think it's going to take 6 months, it will probably take 12. If you think it's going to take 12, it might take 18. And just factor that in and make sure you've got the time, the financial support and so on to get to the start line with that timeline, not the optimistic timeline. And if you can ride that out, then you'll probably be okay.
Yeah.
And as a result for us, it was exactly that. You know, fortunately, we pulled it together. We managed to launch in Selfridges and Harvey Nicks and some brilliant sort of early stage kind of independence. Proud moment walking into Selfridges Food Hall and seeing your brand, you know, displayed out on the fixture. And then not long after that, we launched in Sainsbury's.
Yeah,
and we were off and running. And funnily enough, and this, I really think this is interesting, I think the Ugly Guys would share this story. The first thing they launched is not the thing they made, you know, the thing that made them famous.
They
had, I think, if I'm right, they had a kind of a water-based product in a bottle.
Yeah, it was still, wasn't it?
That had some real operational challenges and obviously led to some insight that led to them launching into carbonates. And the same as for us, like, we launched with jerky and we were proud to be the curator's jerky for the first 12 months of the business. But actually, what we realized was this factory makes really good biltong. Why are we busting our asses to, you know, put all this time and energy into innovating something else? Why don't we launch that too? And that turned out to be a really strong commercial success subsequently. So
yeah, it's that's fascinating as well, isn't it? Because you can't possibly get to the point that you start pivoting or start adding new products unless you've been through the rounds of that, because that's where you then get the idea or you realize it's maybe not quite working, and then what can work and how do you, and it's fascinating, isn't it?
And funnily enough, our best-selling line today, or certainly the one that we produced the most volume on, is it was something that I think it was the third or fourth product we launched.
Yeah,
and that is sometimes the journey brands go on. I think for us, a lot of us, particularly in snacking, innovation is important. Like, we have to put a lot of energy into innovation because the market's moving quickly, and you know, there's a lot of competitors, a lot of product in the market, and that innovation pipeline is really important. But what I think we're now, as a business that's kind of maturing, is maybe not the right word, but you know, we're stabilizing as a business, and we're in a fast growth phase, which is really exciting. And we have now a loyal fan base and some established customers. We're able to be much more disciplined about like the innovation process.
Yeah.
And we're not going to, no longer will we sort of throw a couple of risks out there and sort of see what happens. Like, we need to be quite considered about it now.
Yeah.
Because we've got 50 or 12, 13, 14 products out in the market. So we don't need another five. We might need one or two, you know, more. And just getting that balance right is you know, is difficult, but you have to be really considered about it as you go through the different stages of the brand maturing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I'd love to hear as well, just kind of before we wrap up, is something that Mariana and I ask quite a lot, but is around, you have a fantastic growing business and you also have a family that's at home. How does Ed switch off? How do you kind of take the day to day? Like, I think a lot of people listening, and I know certainly for myself, I am criminal for the business has now become my life. And finding little useful nuggets that people can go, actually, maybe you've cracked it, or you've worked out what is sort of working for you. Like, talk us through that.
Oh, I don't know about cracking it, mate. I mean, it's a constant journey, isn't it? And I would say, like, in those early years, I'm obviously happy to talk about it in a reasonably flippant way. There were some really tough moments. There's some really tough moments, like proper head in hand moments. Like, why are we doing this? I'm killing myself to get this business up and running. Will it ever happen? And can I, you know, being blunt about it, can I feed my family? You know, like, that sounds a bit dramatic, but I walked away from, a pretty comfortable career existence and into one that was no salary for 2 years and all the other stresses that comes with that.
Yeah.
So really, for me personally, I mean, I'm extremely fortunate that I have a very strong support network. Don't take that for granted, whether it's my wife who suffers the journey with me and has done a couple of times, because we were together when I was involved in the Suso business as well. And also my family. I've got two brothers who I'm very close to, and my parents I'm very close to. And you do have to lean on them. Like I mentioned it before, just ask for help. Don't sit there suffering on your own. Whoever that might be, offload that stuff together with someone you trust to take that in the right way. Share the highs, because the highs are amazing, but don't forget to share the difficult stuff either. I think it's really important you find this middle ground, and it's very hard. And I can only do this now as the benefit of hindsight, looking back, because I'm not sure I always got this right. But nothing is ever as bad as it seems, and nothing is ever as brilliant as it seems. Like, you have to find some middle ground. You'll win a new bit of business that you just think is like, oh, this is going to change our world, and we've made it. And it's like, have you really? Okay, you just got started. Or you might lose a bit of business that you think, oh no, this is us done, and the end of the line. We've lost our biggest customer, and it's like, well, it doesn't have to be. So trying to ride out, I'm getting much better at being a bit more stoic. I really recommend reading some stuff around stoicism. I think it's quite interesting. I'm not a great reader, but I have found solace in the last year in just a bit of, you know, reading on mindset and attitudinal stuff, which I find quite interesting. I do have two young kids, which is why I look about 92 and I'm only 43. And it's pretty hard work. But, you know, if I'm honest, those difficult days when it was really tough, it doesn't take, you know, long for a cuddle from a four-year-old and a bedtime story. And you sort of sit there and you think, oh, all right, it's not the end of the world. There's other stuff in my life, you know, try and be grateful for what I've got.
Yeah.
So that family stuff is huge. And funnily enough, like in the last year, I mean, COVID's been a nightmare for so many young businesses and put huge pressure on founders. you know, to work really hard through that, the barriers, and with less resources, no one wants to spend money on another hire. It's like, oh, don't worry, I'll just do it. And it was tough. But actually, I think I've probably looked after myself better in the last year than I ever have.
Yeah.
For me, it's running. It's a bit of, it's going to sound so ridiculous to some of my friends who listen to this, but I do like a bit of like mindfulness, breathing exercises, bit of meditation.
Yeah.
I've got really into Wim Hof, which is quite embarrassing.
Amazing.
But I think he's absolutely amazing. A little bit of a man crush. And he does a lot of breathing exercises, and I'm horrible gnaws about this, and everyone I speak to gets lectured about cold showers, which are my new savior. I do them every day, and it is absolutely amazing. So yeah, I've really enjoyed the last year with a bit of, funnily enough, like, although the disasters around the industry and seeing so many people suffer, like on a personal note, it's actually been reclaiming some time.
Yeah.
And because you know, I was forced to, you know, the first lockdown was bloody awful with the kids at, you know, schooling and stuff, but the last lockdown was actually quite zen in a weird way.
Yeah.
Is that because your kids were back at nursery?
Well, no, because they had
the difference.
They're 10 and 8, so they had like they had online learning portals this time around. The first lockdown was absolute shit show. Like, there will be a lot of parents the last year has just beaten the stuffing out a little bit, if I'm honest. But again, you know, surround yourself with great people. We've got a phenomenal team at the Creators. We're on, humbly, I think we're on fire at the moment. We're growing faster than we ever have. We've launched new products. None of that would be possible without a team. Can't do it all. And I don't know all the answers, and nor does Max.
Yeah.
So, you know, build a great team, look after yourself, and just hold on to the good stuff that is not work-related, that keeps you real, like your family and your friends and stuff. Like, it's easy to say, but those are the things that I try to do to remember that if it's been a crap week, or I'm having imposter syndrome or whatever, just hold on to that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the kind of mindfulness stuff and the meditation stuff is so key. Like, I've explored it as well, and it's kind of, it goes against the grain slightly talking about it and putting yourself out there, because it does have a stigma attached to it. But is the calm app is something that I use regularly in a bath, and just a lot. Like, I think meditation.
Oh, hang on, where are you going with this, Harry?
I've got, as I said that, I was like, maybe tone it back.
an old fashioned Negroni and a cigar.
Yeah. and actually, like, the kind of word meditation has a stigma around it. But really, all it is just creating a little bit of mental clarity and an opportunity to reflect and think on it.
But look, the stress comes, right? It definitely comes. No matter how good you think you're controlling it, there'll always be times the stress comes. You know, we go through phases with our businesses, don't we? Whether it's a fundraise process, or, you know, a customer, you're going through a strategic piece with a customer, or, you're trying to build your team and you're spending your time interviewing. There'll always be stress points. But as I say, come back to fundamental principles. Like, it's never as bad as you think. Take a deep breath. Spend some time on yourself. Remember, you've got the family and the support network, and just go again the next day. Like, you have to be stoic.
Yeah.
It's not a straight line journey. You've got to have the resilience and be a bit stoic. And that is bloody hard to do sometimes, but it's keeping me going at this tender age.
Well, that's it. I think you just got to fucking love the process as well, don't you?
Yeah.
You really, like, I know that is going full on out, but it is, like, a lot of people that we've had on here that talk about some tough times and really pulling through, but they're still, not one bit of them is going, I can't continue this. They're going, right, this was really shit, this is how I dealt with it, but now we're going again, and we're like, and it's all
the passion. Look, some companies genuinely do close, right? So it's not like, you know, there is a point where you have to probably excel. I just listened to your lovely podcast with the Podology founder, and, you know, talking through her moment of realization where it was like, I'm actually going to have to close this business. And that must be horrendous feeling, like, absolutely gut-wrenching. You put so much emotional energy and effort into it. But did she come out the other side of it? Is she happy?
Yeah, totally. And she's up and running again and doing something else. It might just need to change what you're doing.
And I'm so glad you shared that story, because I had that in the aftermath of Suso. I had, you know, like, oh, how am I going to get another job? And this was supposed to kind of set me up for my life and all the rest of it. And it doesn't have to be that extreme. You know, you will, if you're talented enough to get a business off the ground that has some value, you're talented enough to do something for someone else or do something else. You know, it's not.
I think where that gets really complicated, though, is when you have investors.
Yeah.
And it's not just your decision to quit and
write
off your money. But when you have to look somebody in the eye and say, look, dude, not going to happen.
100%. I feel, and we, you know, we're a business that is now funded by external investors, you know, so we feel extremely accountable. And actually nothing would make me happier than making them proud and fulfilling the potential that they've seen in us. Cause you know, it's humbling when someone's prepared to give you their hard earned cash to help grow this thing that you conceived of down a pub one night, you know?
It's crazy, isn't it? Crazy.
So hopefully we'll get there. I feel like the journey's there to be had now.
I'm sure you will. That's it. And Ed, talk to us. I'd love to hear a little bit about kind of the Curator's Range, where we can find you, where everyone can kind of get involved.
Oh, thank you, mate. Where to begin? Like, I couldn't be more excited about this year, really, for a number of reasons. We've actually, lockdown or the COVID dramas of the last year did a couple of quite interesting things for the business, actually. I'm probably not alone in sharing this insight, but people buy a lot of stuff online these days. And our online business has really, really grown. I mean, 700-800% in the last in the last year, which is incredible from a reasonably small base in January of 2019, but to a pretty significant size now. And I think it has the potential to continue that growth, which is really exciting. So our website, wearethecurators.com, but also on Amazon, are a great place to get hold of us. We still have a fantastic relationship with Sainsbury's. I you know, really enjoy trading with them. You know, been a difficult year for them too, that their numbers were announced recently. So they've invested so much energy in making their stores safe and keeping the offer relevant in a really difficult environment. So I'm just excited to do more with Sainsbury's over the next 12 months. So you find us there. Our meat snacks range is growing. We now have a range of chorizo sticks and biltong sticks. We're launching some innovation in June, which I think is really exciting. And our core business is our biltong and our pork puffs, which are absolutely flying. Proud to say our pork puffs are the number one product on Amazon in our category. Hey. And bizarrely enough, they're in the top 150 of all grocery products on Amazon, which includes toilet roll and Lindt chocolate and a few other things.
What an achievement, mate.
That's pretty cool. That's a bit of a pinch yourself moment sometimes. And then in January, mate, we launched, as I think you know, we launched a range of plant-based meal solutions in Tesco, which, I mean, I could bore you all night about the why, but in short, we're all about bringing a bit of sort of foodie flair to food that has great function. So, you know, whether it be the protein from our biltong or the fiber and the mushroom content in our mushroom burgers, like, we want to bring some foodie flair to food that has substantive nutritional stuff going on. And that's been a brilliant project, and Tesco have been fantastic and supported it from the get-go. So available in stores nationwide now. Just excited about the whole channels opening up. We'll talk about this on Friday, mate, when we're swinging the metal sticks in anger.
I cannot wait.
But you know, food service is opening up. We're getting our first orders again through some of our wholesalers into food service. The on trade is a great growth area for us. So I just can't wait to get back out into the trade. Like, I've just missed customers. I've missed those moments that you have, you know, walking into a shop or a pub or whatever, and just like chatting to a catering manager. Like, they're simple small things, but I've really missed that.
It is that, isn't it? Like, we with the very small team, there's only three of us, but we were out today in Shoreditch, literally just kind of backpack on, all our MPD in the backpack, like literally walking around. Brilliant. Pulling out of the wholesalers, and it was like, just for the first moment where I was like, wow, like, because we launched in December 2019, which is like possibly the worst fucking time anyone could launch anything, right? So we only had like 2 months really of kind of real trading before COVID hit. So it's so nice to get back out. And that there is an element of kind of optimism in the air at the moment, isn't it? Which I think we should all be excited about.
I think so. Fingers crossed, right? I think the industry deserves it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mariana, anything from your side?
No, that was really, really good. I can relate to so much of that.
Brilliant. Where can I get hold of some Hullabaloo?
At the moment, really online only. So Amazon and our website. Make a hullabaloo. Thanks. But I will be sending you some.
No. I pay my way. I think it's important. I like to
my little South African children will appreciate some
I'll put some coppers through the pills, don't you worry. Great. And looking forward to seeing more from the Savourists this year. You guys are gonna mix it up with some new lines, right?
Let's hope so, mate. Yeah, absolutely. We've got tomorrow is going, like, we're doing a kind of consumer launch, and then trade stuff has just been kind of going through, which is quite exciting. So yeah,
they are so good. I got to taste them; they are delicious.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. No,
it's a great idea. I'm just going to write it down on my innovation sheet.
It's an exciting time, mate, and it is like exactly kind of going through the process of current range and sort of just exactly what we were speaking about, like learning what needs to change and what needs to add and how do we pivot and how do we evolve and all that such as. But yeah, no, it's an exciting time.
Well, last thing, mate, just to say, sorry, if anyone genuinely, and I don't know if I can help, I might have some answers, I might not, but if anyone wants to reach out, I've said like ask for help, and it's only right that I offer my platform. If you want to email me, ed@wearethecurators.com.
Amazing.
We check our emails regularly. We'll always respond.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Untold, brought to you by Hullabaloo and the Savourists.
Remember to always look after yourself and put your mental health first. Even during the tough times, there's always a solution around the corner. Take care. We'll see you next time. All the best.
Untold was produced and presented by Harry Turpin and Mariana Herald. You can find out more about the Savourists by visiting thesavourists.com, and you can find out more about Hullabaloo by visiting makeahullabaloo.com. The special guest was Ed Hock, and sound engineering was by me, Andy Blackaby-Isles.